From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the rise of Al-Qaeda. Writer Lawrence Wright chronicles the strange journey of Osama bin Laden, from his fanciful boasts about heroics in Afghanistan to his farming days in Sudan, and on to building an organization he believed would destroy the United States, all while letting his own kids play Nintendo. Lawrence Wright's new book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Emperor's Children, A Comedy of Manners by Claire Massoud. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Few Westerners have probed the personalities, principles, and operations of Al-Qaeda like our guest, writer Lawrence Wright. He spent nearly 5 years researching his new book, interviewing more than 600 people, including members of Al-Qaeda and related jihadist groups, as well as friends and relatives of Osama bin Laden. His book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, explores the development of Al-Qaeda, as well as the efforts of FBI agents to crack the organization before it carried out the September 11th attack. Lawrence Wright spent 2 years teaching at the American University in Cairo in the late 1960s. He's authored 6 previous books and has written for The New Yorker and other publications. He also co-wrote the screenplay for The Siege, a 1998 film starring Bruce Willis and Denzel Washington about the nation's reactions to a band of Islamic terrorists. Well, Lawrence Wright, welcome to Fresh Air. Osama bin Laden is known to a lot of people as a man who really made his bones in Afghanistan in the 1980s, recruiting and leading Arabs in the fight against the Russian invasion there. Your book looks at that in some detail. How significant was bin Laden and his Arab recruits? How significant was their role in the war?
It was utterly insignificant. In fact, they were an obstacle to victory, if anything. The Afghans were mystified by these death-seeking Arabs who came seeking martyrdom to Afghanistan when the Afghan people really were seeking liberation. So they had completely different objectives. The Arabs, when they arrived, had no idea that the Soviets might actually be defeated. They were only looking to engage in jihad and find their way to paradise. So oftentimes they would rush into battle and complicate things immensely and get killed in great numbers as they did. But they really contributed nothing to the eventual outcome, which was the withdrawal of the Soviet forces.
However, their exploits were in fact sold in the Arab world as pretty remarkable, right?
Bin Laden in particular was a wonderful spin master. And after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989, the entire Soviet Union fell apart. And so the mythology just grew that, you know, this band, this legend of this small band of men that rushed in to defend Islam and then slayed the mighty superpower so thoroughly that it completely disappeared. That grew up around bin Laden, and he did a lot to create that mythology himself.
Now, there was this character, Abdullah Azzam, who was a Palestinian cleric who became involved in recruiting Arabs from other countries to go fight in Afghanistan. And he told some really tall tales, I guess, about what he and his Arab compatriots were doing in Afghanistan.
Abdullah Azzam was really the godfather of the jihad. He went around the world, and especially he went to Jeddah, which was bin Laden's hometown, and began talking about this war and telling tales of miracles that occurred in Afghanistan, of fighters who would find bullet holes in their clothing but weren't wounded. Those who actually died, their blood would never stop pouring and their bodies would never putrefy, and their green birds would surround them and sing songs of paradise. And all of these tales became a part of the legend that lured these young men to this magical place, Afghanistan. As it happens, actually, Azzam would pay people to bring him these stories, and so the more lurid they were, sometimes the more they would get paid, and no doubt they got bigger and bigger as the years passed by.
Now, even though bin Laden and his fellow Arab fighters weren't effective as a military force and often left out and ignored by the real Afghan fighters, You write that bin Laden himself began to develop a vision of maintaining a core of Islamic fighters for future efforts. What exactly was he conceiving of then?
Originally, he was an anti-communist. His goal was to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan and then on through Central Asia. And also, he was particularly attached to his ancestral homeland, Yemen, which had a communist government at that time. So his conception was that he was going to create a Muslim, specifically an Arab, foreign legion that could be on call to go wherever in the world Muslims were oppressed, especially by communists. And when the Soviet Union then proceeded to fall apart, there was bin Laden with a small army, but no enemy.
Now, he makes his way back to Saudi Arabia after the Russians retreat in 1989. What is his status in the country then?
He was a really paradoxical figure in Saudi Arabia, which is a place where, you know, the royal family really hoards all the glory. You know, there are no photographs, no portraits of anyone other than the leading princes. All the hospital wings are named after them, the streets and so on. So if you're not royal, you may be rich, but you're really not anyone. You're just living, you're a guest in the House of Saud. And here came this young man who was rich, who was glamorous, who was ambitious, who had a small army at his disposal. And he became Saudi Arabia's first celebrity, which was a category they hadn't had to contend with before that.
Did he see himself then as a jihadist, or was he a guy who was going to raise his children and stay with his wives?
After bin Laden came back to Saudi Arabia in 1989, he settled down. He was investing in companies in Jeddah and Medina, and something happened, though, that disrupted that kind of peaceful idyll. In 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and the Iraqi army was poised on the Saudi border. And, of course, the kingdom was in a panic about what to do. And bin Laden went to the defense minister and proposed that he would use his organization, Al-Qaeda, to defend the kingdom, along with several hundred thousand unemployed Saudi youth and the bulldozers and caterpillars that were at his disposal at the Saudi bin Laden company. The Iraqi army had 1 million men. It was one of the largest tank corps in the world. And the defense minister just laughed at him. And the king then invited the Americans to come save them from the Iraqi threat. Bin Laden was really offended by this, offended by his treatment, offended that the Saudis would turn to heretics and apostates as he saw the Americans and bring them onto the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia, where, as the Prophet said on his deathbed, there should be no two religions in Arabia. He saw this as a huge offense against Islam.
So Osama bin Laden comes into conflict with the royal family of Saudi Arabia because he condemns them for their invitation of U.S. troops in. It eventually reaches the point where he has to leave and makes his way to Sudan. How did he come to resettle in the country of Sudan?
Well, Sudan had just gone through an Islamic revolution and led by this philosopher king named Hassan al-Turabi. And Turabi had sent emissaries to bin Laden to invite him to come to Khartoum because he knew that bin Laden was very rich and involved in the construction business, and he wanted someone like that to come invest in Sudan. At the time, the Sudanese government opened the country to anyone who said he was a Muslim. And consequently, a number of different terrorist groups who were unwanted in their own countries began streaming into Khartoum. And it became a haven for the PLO, the PFLP, Abu Nidal group. Every known terrorist group seemed to have a foothold, if not a headquarters, in Khartoum. And it was into this nest of very dissident factions that bin Laden arrived in 1992, bringing the kind of straggly band of al-Qaeda fighters from Afghanistan and other points to reassemble there and set up camps.
But the remarkable thing is, as you describe it, he ends up sort of finding a happy pastoral life. He invests in several businesses, and at one point says, "I'm through with fighting."
Yeah, he loved farming. He loved the kind of scientific side of it, too. He was involved in genetic experimentation with seeds. He proudly boasted that he grew the largest sunflowers in the world and that they should be in the Guinness Book of World Records. He would actually carry sunflowers around to show people how big they were. So he was very entranced by his business life, but especially the agricultural life.
So what brought him back to jihad?
Well, there were several things, but I think the main thing was the presence of the American troops in his home country. He saw that as such an insult, and he was inflamed by that. He spoke out against the presence of the Americans, and he was also supporting the Egyptian groups that were in Sudan who were waging a war on their native country. And the Egyptians complained repeatedly to the Saudis, and this kind of pressure eventually caused the king of Saudi Arabia to revoke bin Laden's citizenship, and that was another insult. So a series of personal slights led him to conclude that he was going to turn again to terrorism. And at about that time, a probable cause came along in the famine in Somalia. And there was an international relief corps sent, including American troops, who were there to try to alleviate the suffering of all these people in Somalia. Al-Qaeda theorists looked at what they call the invasion of Somalia as an attempt to capture the Horn of Africa. And so bin Laden dispatched Al-Qaeda trainers to help the Somalis in resisting this foreign occupation as they saw it. And he may well have trained the people that shot down the Black Hawk helicopters the Americans were killed in Mogadishu. So the turn towards terrorism actually took place in those otherwise idyllic years in Sudan.
Lawrence Wright's new book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Lawrence Wright. His new book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. You know, the retreat of the American forces from Somalia has been cited as another example in which Islamic fighters stood up to the United States and forced it to retreat. You said earlier that Osama bin Laden had done a great job of spinning his role in Afghanistan. Did he exaggerate his role in Somalia as well? How did he describe his role and the role of his compatriots in Somalia?
Well, he often takes credit for things that he doesn't really deserve, and then sometimes he denies having done things. But in Somalia, they seem to have had very little to do with the actual fighting. They probably did have something to do with some of the training of the Somali tribesmen. But bin Laden took credit for having shot down, or at least having sponsored that, and shot down the Black Hawk helicopters. And the lesson he drew from that was that just a small strike against the Americans will send them running. They were not a frightening foe. All they had to do was kill a few servicemen, and then they drag their tail out of there as quickly as they can.
You mentioned earlier that he was involved with Egyptians in Sudan. Now, these were Islamic fundamentalists who had for decades been fighting against the secular government of Egypt, right?
That's correct, led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, a medical doctor who had started a cell to overthrow the Egyptian government when he was 15 years old.
And they also, the other Islamic groups in Egypt staged some spectacular and bloody attacks on tourist shrines in Egypt, too, right?
You know, the war in Egypt, it was one of the most savage experiences, you know, in the 90s. It was, there were not just al-Jihad, which was Zawahiri's group. There was Gamal Islamiyah, which was led by their spiritual leader, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman. And between the two groups, they were responsible for the murder of hundreds and hundreds of people in Egypt and dozens of foreign tourists, especially at the Shrine of Luxor in 1997, where 57 tourists were shot down and butchered. It was just an appalling rampage of terror that turned the Egyptian people against them so thoroughly that it actually permitted the government to behave when the government rounded them up and put them in concentration camps. Anybody that was even suspected of being sympathetic or saying anything sympathetic for the cause of the terrorists was thrown in prison. Young men women were drawn out in the streets and stripped naked and told if your son is not here next time, you'll be raped in the street. It was really barbaric warfare on both parts, but it ended with all of the Egyptian elements of Zawahiri's people being rounded up, and eventually the terrorists inside Egypt declared a truce, and until recently that has not been violated.
Now did the role of the Egyptians in Sudan in some of these atrocities, is that what prompted the government of Sudan to ultimately decide it had to expel al-Qaeda?
Yes, the pressure, international pressure, was just way too great on the Sudanese. And the Americans were very engaged in trying to get bin Laden out of there. This was unfortunate. It was a real strategic error on the part of the Americans, because we had at that time no indictment. The Sudanese actually offered to turn him over to us, but what were we going to do? We didn't know anything about his involvement in Somalia, and we might not have been able to get a conviction on that in any case. He had not yet really done any of his terrorist actions against Americans. We only knew of him as an Islamic financier who was backing some of these groups. So the Sudanese told us, listen, we have him under control here. We know where he is. We know what he's doing. You know, if we send him away, he might be a lot more trouble. And they were so right about that.
Well, in the late 90s, Osama bin Laden is compelled to leave Sudan. And he's then a man without a country. It's remarkable to read, you know, we think of him as a rich and powerful guy, but he ends up making his way to Afghanistan, and he's essentially broke and powerless, right?
That's right. The Saudis had cut off his allowance from the Saudi bin Laden group, his father's company, which was essentially the only way he made any money. When he went to Sudan, he was worth about $7 million. That's about how much his portion of that company was worth. And he had an annual allowance that sometimes amounted to as much as $500,000. That was a substantial amount of money in Sudan. And so at that time, you know, the legend of him being a billionaire had spread around. He was not anywhere near that. But when he left Sudan, all of his investments were essentially stolen by the Sudanese government. He was almost penniless. He may have had, one Sudanese intelligence officer told me that he might have had about $50,000. But bin Laden's business manager, a man named Abdurrida al-Suri, said he was penniless. So when he got to Afghanistan, he had to throw himself on the mercy of some of the old warlords that he used to fight with.
And what kind of conditions did he and his wives and his children who were there with him and his operatives endure when they first settled in Afghanistan?
There are stories of them eating nothing but raw pomegranates, unripe pomegranates, and stale bread, and drinking well water that had larvae in it. They were living in a really, really impoverished and desperate state. Actually, bin Laden always responded to those kinds of situations. Privation, stoic life, that was always what he sought. And when the Taliban offered him a choice of places to stay, one that had utilities and air conditioning, and the other which had nothing, that was called Tarnak Farms, he chose the place that was really stripped of any kind of accoutrements of modern life. That he said he wanted his people to be ready for to bear anything.
And he related this to an episode in the life of the Prophet Muhammad, right?
Well, like many strict Muslims, bin Laden had always sought to emulate the Prophet in every respect. And so since childhood, he has fasted on Mondays and Thursdays, and he attempts to sit in the way that we think that the Prophet sat and dress in the same clothing as much as possible. He's always had a strong sense of what resonates with other Muslims. For instance, the cave, which seems odd and anomalous to a modern Westerner, the cave is a richly symbolic place for Muslims because it's where the Prophet went and was first heard the word of God. It's where he sought refuge. The cave, you know, stalactite imagery and so on is always present in Islamic art. So he had it was both his own personal drive, I'm sure, but also his attempt to become an icon of pure Islamic thinking and life that led him to behave in this fashion.
Lawrence Wright's new book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Where Soldiers Fear to Tread, a relief worker's tale of survival in war-ravaged Somalia by John S. Burnett. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, interviewing the friends and relatives of bin Laden. We continue our conversation with Lawrence Wright, author of The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews The Emperor's Children, the new novel by Claire Massoud. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Writer Lawrence Wright spent nearly 5 years researching his new book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. It explores the personalities of key jihadist leaders, including Osama bin Laden. Wright said a low point of bin Laden's terrorist career was his expulsion from Sudan in 1996, when he fled to Afghanistan. So he's in Afghanistan with his followers, with his family, and he's broke. He's cut off from the wealth that his family's construction business had generated in Saudi Arabia. What turns around his fortune? Where does he get the money to once again become a threat and a force?
First of all, he made an alliance with the Taliban. When the Taliban were besieging Kabul, and bin Laden had arrived, he thought that they were probably communist. He had no idea who the Taliban really were. But the Taliban took care of him for a while. You know, he had old alliances in the Saudi kingdom and friends who would bring him some money. And he didn't need much. This is one of the things about al-Qaeda that's so striking, is how cheaply they are able to operate. He sent several operatives down to Africa to start a cell in Kenya and one in Tanzania. And they had to earn their own living. They went into the fishing business, for instance, and very, very marginal. But when he was able to bomb the two American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in August of 1998, that was, you know, a very dramatic event. But our response to that event, to send 56 cruise missiles over that did a lot of harm but no damage to al-Qaeda, that elevated him in the eyes of many disaffected Muslims in the world, and it completely restored his fortunes with them.
Give us a sense of what kind of leader Osama bin Laden was. I mean, he does not, from your account, to appear to be a riveting orator, and yet he somehow did inspire people. How was he effective as a leader?
Well, certainly in the beginning, he was not an effective leader. He was under the spell of Abdullah Azzam, a very charismatic, commanding figure. But bin Laden always had this dream of creating this Arab Legion. And there was another man that saw in bin Laden the possibilities for real leadership. And this man was Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Egyptian, who had spent 3 years in Egyptian prisons and had emerged a hardened propagandist. He saw bin Laden and knew what to do with him, a little like maybe Colonel Parker saw Elvis. You know, I mean, he saw the possibility here. He saw that this young man at that time had a lot of money. He was a Saudi, which has great standing in the Muslim world because they're seen as being the most holy of people. And he was rich, and here he was living in these deprived circumstances fighting jihad. All of those things had not occurred to bin Laden that they could become iconic, but Zawahiri immediately recognized their utility, and he put them to use. So when bin Laden began to talk about creating al-Qaeda, Zawahiri surrounded him with his own Egyptian leaders, people that were military men, policemen, technocrats, engineers, the kind of people that could really put together that operation. And by that, he really captured bin Laden and his dream and steered it into the organization that it is now. I would have to say I'm not intending to slight bin Laden and his leadership, because if it weren't for bin Laden, we wouldn't have the al-Qaeda we have now. Most of these groups, these jihadi groups, are nationalistic in focus. It was bin Laden that decided to make this kind of international umbrella and put them all under one tent and direct them mainly towards America.
It was around this time, I believe, that he issued his widely publicized fatwa on America, right?
That's right. It was in 1996 that he declared war on America. And then in 1998, he issued a fatwa allowing anyone to kill Americans wherever they see them. The emergence of America as the enemy is a little puzzling, because, you know, America had been so helpful during the jihad against the Soviets, although they never worked with the Arabs directly. They had certainly helped the Afghan cause. And also, America was a very religious country. It was tolerant of Muslims, whereas, you know, the Soviet Union had destroyed 50,000 mosques. So the contrast was quite stark. But I think that bin Laden saw America as the leading edge of the West and of modernity. And it was those things that he was fighting against. by picking the biggest enemy, by picking the next superpower, he automatically elevated him and his cause. If you turn your fire against America and then really do hurt it and draw its attention, then it elevates you in the eyes of the world, and especially in the eyes of other Muslims that he was trying to recruit. So all along, the idea of the clash of civilizations was one that bin Laden sponsored. He wanted to draw America in. He wanted to provoke it. He hoped at the time that he could draw America into Afghanistan. And eventually, of course, he did. And it turned out quite differently from what he imagined. I think that perhaps Iraq is more what he thought Afghanistan would look like when the Americans arrived.
You mentioned that when he first came to Afghanistan, conditions were very sparse. After the successful bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, money and recruits came in at a much larger scale, and you describe an al-Qaeda which was quite a large going concern, and some of the procedures they had, they actually had, what, salaries? They had policies?
Right. Paid vacations, a month-long vacation, and the health care benefits, and you get a round-trip ticket home each year. It was all very bureaucratic. One of the things that bin Laden brought to the world of terror is a lot of managerial expertise and a kind of bureaucratic overlay. You'd have to fill out forms in triplicate in order to buy new tires, for instance. But all of this imposed a certain discipline that hadn't been present in that kind of organization before.
I know that for this book, you interviewed many people who were friends and associates and relatives of al-Qaeda members. Tell us a little bit about the life in the Afghanistan camp for Osama bin Laden's wives and children. I mean, did they live an ascetic life, or were they?
Oh, yes, they did. He had four wives at a time. Altogether, he's had five. But when he got to Afghanistan, he had three, since one of them had divorced him in Sudan. She couldn't take the life anymore. She went back to Saudi Arabia. So he arrived back in Afghanistan in 1996, penniless, with 17 children and three wives. In the popular idea is that you couldn't listen to music, you couldn't have pictures on the wall, and there was no games and all that sort of thing. But bin Laden actually bent the rules for his own children. He allowed his boys to have Nintendo, for instance. He had calendars with pictures of horses, which is many see as un-Islamic. His three different wives, they lived in the same compound. Two of them were, quite devout, but his first wife, is Najla, who's called Abdullah because she's the mother of his first son, Abdullah. She was actually, she married him when she was 14 years old and he was 17. And she must have expected that she was going to live a life, on yachts and in the Swiss casinos and shops on the Champs-Élysées and so on. That must have been what she had in mind. And here she was in Afghanistan. Whenever someone went out of the country to Canada or the U.S. or Europe, she would ask them to bring her cosmetics and lingerie. She never gave up her dream of being young and beautiful. She would often run laps around the compound in a tracksuit. It's a kind of sad story about Abdullah, because bin Laden eventually remarried a 15-year-old Yemeni girl, and then Abdullah had it with him, and she left him and went back to Syria.
My guest is Lawrence Wright. His new book is called The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Lawrence Wright. His new book, The Looming Tower, chronicles the rise of al-Qaeda and the life of Osama bin Laden. You know, how do you reconcile his tolerance of these accoutrements of Western culture in a camp when he is at the same time, you know, inspired by such religious zeal that he will cause the deaths of thousands of people to pursue an Islamic cause?
Well, he was always, he was very strict with his children in terms of taking them out and exposing them to hardship. But he always had a kind of soft side, and he liked to go riding. He liked to play games with them. He was never very interested in their education, although he read to them sometimes. So I guess as a family man, he tried to impose a certain kind of normality. In fact, I heard this repeated several times by people who were family members in al-Qaeda, that there was a kind of normality about life, even in these extremely hard circumstances. You know, people had weddings, they had meals together, they tried to make things feel fun and normal. As strange as that may sound, I think that it's a very common thing to try to form a community and allow children a certain degree of flexibility because they're living in such really pressed circumstances.
During this time, bin Laden and this organization is responsible for incredible savagery. There were the attacks, the bombings of the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and the attack on the USS Cole in Yemen. Where did the idea for the 9/11 attack come from?
Well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was, first of all, not a member of al-Qaeda at the time. He came to visit bin Laden in 1996. His nephew, Ramzi Youssef, had been the mastermind of the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, which killed six people and really actually sent more people to the hospital. It was a terrible incident. It doesn't seem so big in retrospect, but there were more people hospitalized by that than any other civil action since the Civil War. So it was a very bad bombing, and he became kind of legendary in these underground jihadi circles. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, his uncle, had fled the Philippines after the Philippine police had caught on to their plotting to destroy these airliners over the Pacific. And so he found his way to Afghanistan to try to sell his vision of this airline plot. Very similar to the recent one in Britain, where they were going to get on 12 American airliners, mix some chemicals together on board, and blow them up over the Pacific. So this is the scenario that he was trying to peddle to bin Laden. And bin Laden at the time thought it was too complicated, and yet he wanted Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to join al-Qaeda. And he wouldn't do that at that time, but a few years passed, and he did come back in and began working with bin Laden. They refined the plot over a couple of years. It started out with, we're going to hijack these airliners in the Pacific. But then bin Laden started thinking about another alternative, which was to train these men to actually be the pilots and to use the aircraft as weapons, not just as bombs.
As the 9/11 attack approaches, you describe bin Laden in Afghanistan gathering his followers and retreating to a kind of a mountain hideout. I guess this was Tora Bora, right? And bringing a satellite receiver and a TV set because he knows the attack is coming. Most of those around him do not. And you write that that he and a number of al-Qaeda members are beset by vivid dreams involving airplanes.
Yes, these premonitory dreams were just rife. People were imagining dreams of pilots playing soccer, for instance, and actual dreams of airplanes hitting buildings. And there was a culture in al-Qaeda where people would come to tell bin Laden or one of the other leaders about their dreams, and they would just sit around and discuss them and what kind of premonitory events these might presage. And bin Laden finally told them, no more dreams about airplanes. He didn't want the plot to be given away in this supernatural fashion.
Well, were these people who were having these dreams, did the people who were having these dreams know about the plot?
No, they were, the plot itself was very closely held. And many people knew something was up, but the actual nature of the plot was, at least according to bin Laden's rendition of it, was the people that were having these dreams weren't aware that the airplanes were actually going to be used.
You talk to a lot of, I guess, former friends, associates, relatives of Al-Qaeda members. How did you get them to talk to you?
You know, it's taken 5 years. I've spent a lot of time talking to people who know somebody and convincing them to introduce me to them. That's the way that really journalism is done at all levels.
So who were you able to reach? Were they bin Laden's wives, children? I mean,
I spoke briefly to one of his children, and I talked to his brother-in-law, Jamal Khalifa, who was extremely helpful to me. And actually, you know, in Saudi Arabia, you don't interview women, especially conservative Muslim women. A man doesn't, anyway. So Jamal did me the favor of interviewing his wife for me. That was very helpful. And I used that technique several times. There were people that wouldn't see me, but I would be able to send questions through an emissary that would take them to him, and then they would send back either typed responses or oral responses that were delivered to me. And that way I was able to communicate with some of the inner core. Then there are the disaffected people that are very important, like Abarida al-Suri, who was a close friend of bin Laden's and his business manager in Khartoum. And I was introduced to him by Sudanese intelligence. So it's serendipity sometimes, as in that case. And Abarida has actually been a really good source for me.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, there was this recent revelation in Britain of an apparent plot to produce explosions on airlines headed to the United
Right.
States. I'm wondering what, as someone who has looked closely at Al-Qaeda, what you're looking at as news emerges of that alleged plot. What are you seeing?
Well, you know, this may be connected to Al-Qaeda or it may not, but it looks like Al-Qaeda. It's certainly from the Al-Qaeda playbook. It's a very complicated plot, which is probably what caused it to fail. The thing that I note is that there was really good police work in this. The British have many more native speakers of Arabic in their forces. They're much more involved in the community. I think rather than taking water bottles out of passengers' hands at the airport, what we really need to concentrate in this country is becoming more integrated in our police services with the Islamic and Arab communities. And that way, we'll really be much more protected than we will be by someone having to leave their contacts lens solution in the men's room. Scaring Americans is not a good choice about fighting Al Qaeda. That's what Al Qaeda wants us to do. I think that if we are accepting of a certain danger out there, that really we can't change except by assiduous police work and by creating allies in the Arab and Muslim world. That's the way we'll begin to defeat Al Qaeda. Al Qaeda itself has nothing to offer. There's no politics to Al-Qaeda. It only says that it wants to take over a country and establish the caliphate and Sharia, which is Islamic law, Well, Sharia is already in effect in Saudi Arabia, for instance, and several other Arab Muslim countries. You can't go to Al-Qaeda and say, what do you propose to do about unemployment, about female education, about the Kyoto Treaty, or anything? They have no answers. They haven't thought about it. It has nothing to offer the Muslim world except a chance for revenge. And if we eliminate the longing for that, then we've destroyed Al-Qaeda.
Well, Lawrence Wright, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Lawrence Wright's new book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan on the new novel by Claire Massoud. This is Fresh Air. Fiction writer Claire Massoud has twice been a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Massoud's new novel, The Emperor's Children, might just be the one to propel her out of the finalist category and win her the gold.
They seem to have the world on a string. They're youngish, good-looking, and connected. Not too long ago, they were all wry Ivy League English majors. Now they have the type of jobs that look great on paper, but don't always cover the rent. Documentary film producer, editor, book critic. Indeed, if they weren't the main characters in Claire Massoud's wonderful new novel, The Emperor's Children, they'd be precisely the kind of people likely to read it. With her own beefy degrees from Yale and Cambridge, her award nominations for her previous books, and her marriage to the preeminent literary critic of our time, James Wood, Massoud is clearly of the culturally elite world she writes, but happily she's not bound by it. The Emperor's Children is a fat, delicious, and very smart comedy of manners. Massoud has thoughtfully overlaid this big, character-driven novel of how some of us live today with a deeply informed echoing of literary history. Rather than showing off her excellent education by writing a flashy meta-novel about everything and nothing, Massoud reaches into her literary kit bag and reworks classic dilemmas and characters via the novels of Wharton, Fitzgerald, and Waugh, to name a few. She complicates those familiar archetypes by unwinding the illusions that wrap her characters in a sense of their own superiority. By the end of this tale, the Emperor's children have no clothes, although one holdout at least remains blind to the naked truth. The Emperor of Massoud's title is Murray Thwaite, a Norman Mailer-ish type of new journalist who soaks himself in scotch and the admiration of the easily seduced young. Murray and his wife Annabel live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in a luxurious flat, as they would call it, that they share with their 30-ish daughter Marina, a beauty who for years has been toying with a book she's contracted to write about children's fashion. Marina is the kind of woman who's been so stunted by her own golden good fortune that she's capable of earnestly assuring her merely attractive girlfriend, Danielle, that she, Danielle, is lucky because she'll never have to worry about whether guys like her for her looks or for herself. The third amigo, Julius, is a gay freelance critic whose most shameful secret doesn't have to do with the sex or drugs he indulges in, but with the fact that he's been obliged to sign up with a temp agency to pay his bills. While at the outset of the novel, Julius still thinks he's hot stuff, here's how he wisely marks the difference between himself and Marina. It all came down to entitlement and one's sense of it. Marina, feeling entitled, never really asked herself if she was good enough, whereas he, Julius, asked himself repeatedly, answered always in the affirmative, and marveled at the wider world's apparent inability to see the light. As I hope you can hear from that quote, a lot of the pleasure of reading The Emperor's Children derives from its language, which entertains because of its droll precision. For instance, Danielle, the most insightful and thus inevitably most melancholy of the characters, reflects on growing up and coupling as a process of growing away from mirth. Nominally content, she thinks, one grew to fear jokes and their capacity to unsettle. Throughout the course of the novel, all three friends grow less mirthful as they fall for partners who are decidedly bad for them. Marina, most gruesomely, hitches up with a slick, intellectual lounge lizard from Australia who's starting a new magazine in New York that he pompously announces will foment a revolution by debunking intellectual pomposity. It's fast becoming a literary cliché that contemporary New York novels climax with September 11th. The fact that Massoud is able to both sparely invoke that horror and use it in the service of ironic plot resolutions attests to her wizardry as a writer. The main characters in this superb novel may bring on their own misfortunes by taking their distinction for granted, resting on their laurels. But the hard-working Massoud never makes that mistake.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Emperor's Children by Claire Massoud. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Kane, former chair of the 9/11 Commission, says America hasn't done enough to guard against future terror attacks. And he'll describe the Commission's efforts to pry the truth about September 11th from reluctant bureaucrats. He and co-chair Lee Hamilton's new book is Without Precedent, the Inside Story of the 9/11 Commission. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.